Members, I'm going to call the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform to order. And we have a quorum, and so our first order of business will be to move the minutes for March 3rd. Do I have a motion to move those minutes? Representative Backer moves the minutes of March 3rd. Do I have any comments or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Members, the first bill that we have coming forward today is House File 1047, Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, thank you, Representative Whalen. And I will move the bill, and you guys can present the bill. And today, members, when we have testifiers coming forward, each testifier will have 2 to 3 minutes. We're going to be sticking to those timelines pretty tightly, just so all the testifiers know. So to our first bill, I will move that House File 1047
be referred.
Representative Freiberg.
The minutes in my packet appear to be for February 25th, and then the only bill is House File 316 relating to nursing facility reimbursement system. I don't know. But maybe it's true.
We can get your folder fixed immediately. Does everybody else have the bills for the day? Just to make sure, and we'll get that. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. We'll get that fixed right away. Okay. Okay. So, members, I will move that House File 1047 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. Representative Whalen, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have an amendment, which I believe you should have in your packets, A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Whalen has the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author would like it. Members, is there any discussion to the amendment? Or Representative Whalen, if you could maybe walk us through what the amendment is doing,
yeah,
that
happily.
Would be
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the amendment's very simple. All it does is add a reporting requirement on a form that the commissioner already prepares for abortion facilities and physicians who perform abortions to provide information on infants who might survive an abortion. So it's just a few lines and a checkbox on a form. And then it also adds a standard severability clause.
So, members, if there's any specific questions now, otherwise we will put the amendment on, as we customarily do, to get the bill in the order that the author would like it, and then can discuss the bill as such. So, with that, members, all those in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Whalen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To begin, I just would like to briefly share why I have decided to carry this bill. As I was campaigning last year, I came across a book called An Accidental Life, and I actually have it here with me if anybody is interested. It's a fiction story, but it's based on true events, and the more that I read, the more shocked I became. The book tells the story of a young woman who sought an abortion, but neither she nor the doctors knew how far along she was. As the procedure ensued, it became clear she was pretty far along because eventually the young woman heard a cry, and it was the cry of her baby. So just imagine the shock of going through an abortion, thinking your baby's not that far along, not far along enough to create sound, and then you hear an infant cry. In the story, there was only one physician performing an abortion, and he told his assistant to simply take care of it, it being the infant who was struggling for life. Well, again, this is a fiction story. It is based on true events. Many of you may know the story of nurse Jill Stanek, who worked at Christ Hospital in Illinois. In 2001, she provided testimony to Congress that inspired the story, this book. Nurse Stanek tells a tale of finding an infant who survived an abortion alive in a utility room, left to die because the parents did not want to hold him, and the nurse who had assisted in the abortion did not have time to rock him or provide what is termed comfort care. So Nurse Stanek rocked him for 45 minutes, while he struggled to breathe before he eventually died. I could not believe, and I still struggle to believe, that this happens in the United States. We have the technology to help these babies, and there are cases where infants have survived abortions to live full and happy lives. To give a brief background on federal and state laws, right now, infants born alive as a result of failed abortions are recognized as a person, but then the law does very little else. There's no consequence for physicians who fail to provide care to these infants, and this crime continues despite the Born Alive Infant Act passed by Congress more than a decade ago. This bill seeks to address that, at least in Minnesota, and includes civil remedies for physicians who fail to provide care to infants who are born alive as the result of a failed abortion. Several other states already require physicians to provide medical care at any stage of development. In sum, I knew that after reading this book, I had to see if there was more we could do. And the result that you have before you, members and Madam Chair, is House File 1047, as amended. I'll ask for your support, and I'm happy to take questions, but I know we have a few others who would like to testify in favor of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Whalen. Ms. Rao, if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I am here representing MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. We are a pro-life organization with more than 70,000 members and more than 200 chapters across the state. House File 1047 builds on both existing federal and Minnesota-specific law. Shortly after Roe v. Wade legalized abortion for any reason at any time during pregnancy throughout our country, Minnesota passed an early version of what is now called a Born Alive Infant Protection Act. Specifically, our law states that a live child born as a result of an abortion shall be fully recognized as a human person and accorded immediate protection under the law, and all reasonable measures consistent with good medical practice, including the compilation of appropriate medical records, shall be taken to preserve the life and health of the child. Additionally, the law requires that for abortions performed after the 20th week of pregnancy, a second physician must be present at the time of the abortion. The second physician's job is to provide care to the infant if it is born alive. This remains existing law in Minnesota. At the time it became law, saline abortions were the most common type of abortion done on a more well-developed unborn child, one who had a better chance of surviving outside the womb. This procedure involved replacing amniotic fluid with a saline or salt solution. The saline solution was intended to kill the unborn child, essentially chemically burning him or her. After the child was dead, the mother was induced and delivered the baby. But sometimes the saline didn't do its job and the child was born alive. That was the impetus for passing our existing law. Today, saline abortions are only rarely done. Abortionists have nearly perfected procedures less likely to result in a live-born infant. Current procedures done on more well-developed unborn children include injecting digoxin or potassium chloride directly into the unborn child's heart. This causes the unborn child to die almost immediately. Then the mother is induced and delivers a dead baby. Or more commonly, a D&E procedure. This procedure involves the abortionist reaching into the womb with the forceps and dismembering the unborn child, removing the baby in pieces. Digoxin or potassium chloride is sometimes used to cause death to the unborn child in this procedure as well. However, as abortionists have gotten better, not perfect, but better, at ensuring a live-born infant doesn't result from an abortion, neonatal physicians have also gotten much better at saving micro-preemie babies. These are babies born at less than 26 weeks gestation. Now, depending on individual circumstances, tiny babies as young as 23 weeks can survive. While Minnesota doesn't typically have many abortions that occur on babies at this stage of development, most years, there are a few. And even when these tiny babies are not able to survive, Minnesota's law requires that they be provided comfort care, which could include holding the baby until it dies, or even placing it in an appropriate location and covering him or her with a blanket. The legislation before you today would help to clarify and strengthen our existing law that already provides protections to babies who are born alive in an abortion. It would do so in the following ways. First, it would create a definition for born alive with respect to this law. Second, it would allow for civil penalties and professional disciplinary action for offending abortionists. Third, It specifies that an infant born alive during an abortion is a ward of the state, and its parents' rights are terminated unless they agree to accept parental rights for the child. And finally, it confirms, and I quote, "Nothing in this section shall be construed to affirm, deny, expand, or contract any legal status or legal right applicable to any member of the species Homo sapiens at any point prior to being born alive, as defined in this section." In other words, this legislation does not affect whether or not a woman has a right to an abortion. The federal law that provides the basis for the definition in this legislation passed the United States House of Representatives on March 12, 2002 by a voice vote. It was then passed by unanimous consent through the United States Senate on July 18, 2002. I hope that House File 1047 enjoys the same universal support today. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rao, for presentation and explanation of the bill. Members, if there's any immediate questions right now, we'll take those. Otherwise, we'll take the other testifiers and save questions for the end. Okay. Okay, we will move to our next testifier, which is Autumn Leva with the Minnesota Family Council. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. My name is Autumn Leva, and I am the Policy Director for Minnesota Family Council. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for your consideration of these important issues before your committee. Minnesota Family Council wants to make clear that we support all of the legislation before you today, HF 606, 607, 787, and 1047. And we're grateful to Representatives Keel, Tice, Pugh, and Whalen for their leadership in bringing them forward. My brief testimony today will focus specifically on HF 1047, the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. I think that the one thing that folks on both sides of the abortion debate can agree on is that the grasp of Roe versus Wade does not extend to life outside the womb. HF 1047 embodies that point of agreement. HF 1047 is necessary because it ensures that the protections for born alive infants and its federal counterpart are extended to Minnesota hospitals not included under the federal law. The federal law passed with virtually no opposition in 2002, and many states, including California, New York, Illinois, Wisconsin, and many more, have all passed state-level born alive infant protection acts. Minnesota should likewise act to ensure that all its citizens, even its very youngest, receive excellent medical care. We are uniquely blessed in our state with the world-class medical care, and state policy should reflect that those excellent medical services are available to all, especially our most vulnerable and youngest children. The opportunities to find common ground in the abortion debate are often few and far between, but we can all find common ground in the humanity of unborn children, regardless of whether or not they were intended to come into the world at all, regardless of how short or how long their lives end up being, regardless of what they may or may not ultimately contribute to society, and regardless of any disabilities or conditions with which they are actually born. When we come into this world, each of us is a unique creation made in the image of God and deserving of care and compassion and worthy of being welcomed into life by all of us who are here. We urge your support for HF 1047.
Thank you so much for being here. Members, we don't have any other testifiers on the bill that let us know in advance. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify? Okay, we'll move to questions. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't really have a question. I just want to make a comment and correct one thing. The author said that there are no consequences. Without this bill, we have basically the same consequences as with the bill. It's already, I believe, from what I can read of this, I believe it's already murder, and there's already common law civil action. And in fact, in other states where, actually, I only know of one or two cases. Somebody said that this happens. I have not heard of a single case in Minnesota like this. And I know there was a guy whose name started with a G in Pennsylvania that did it. And he is now under the same that we have presently in our law here without this bill. He was convicted and he is serving life without parole, which is the most extreme sentence you can get in the United States other than death, execution. And he was also, I believe, lost a several million dollar lawsuit against him. So the only other one that's even close to that I can think is somebody named, started with a P, I believe, in Florida, if I remember right. Anyhow, I know there was a survey done of attorney generals, and 38 responded that they had not heard of anything in their state, and I've not heard of anything in our state. So I'm certainly not against the bill. I don't think it's, I think it's already the law.
Representative Whalen, to that point.
Yes, thank you, Chairwoman, and thank you, Representative, for your comments. Just briefly to touch on a few points, you mentioned the idea that there are already consequences. I think that what this does is just draws it to light and ensures that there will be consequences. In addition, as to the point of reporting and how often this actually happens, because the reporting on this issue is grossly insufficient, it would require physicians to self report and say, yes, I allowed an infant to die. It's really hard to find information. I will say that the CDC reports between 2001 and 2010, 362 infant deaths nationwide as a result of attempted abortion. There have been similar numbers in Canada and also in Britain. And so while the specific numbers, I think, are actually higher than that because of the lack of reporting and data available, I would say one is too many, and I want to do everything we can to protect the unborn.
Representative Mulry.
Madam Chair and Representative. I think we'd have to have the data on that and see what actually the data is, whether they were born completely alive and then actually were killed. That's what this is really getting at, and as I see it, it's already totally covered under the law.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I think that the one of the testifiers said, you know, we can all agree on the humanity of children who are born. And I think that's absolutely true. We all can. And that's why we have laws against infanticide. And from what I understand, most of the time when there's a killing of a newborn, it's usually by the mother who kind of, you know, goes off her rocker in some way and, you know, commit some horrible act, and that's how we usually hear about that. I don't think this bill does anything in particular about that. But, and I heard you kind of say, well, we're doing this because we want to make sure. Well, I mean, we could repass all our criminal laws just to make sure they're observed. I think it would be kind of a waste of our time. I think this bill is a waste of our time. But I do have a question for you, and that is, why are you putting a severability clause in here? What are you worried about? I mean, the severability clause, just for anyone who may be listening, says that basically if any part of the bill is found to be unconstitutional, that piece can be taken out and the rest of it would stand. And so if you're not worried about it being, you must be worried about it being unconstitutional or you wouldn't put that in there. So what are you worried about being unconstitutional here?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling. I'm actually not worried. It's a standard clause that happens in most legislation of this nature. And I have no control over the court system and what they may or may not decide to do. I disagree with a lot of the things that the court does, and I know that they disagree with a lot of the things that the legislature does. So while I don't believe that anything is unconstitutional and I'm not worried, it is a standard clause, and that's why we added it in.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. And, you know, legislation of this nature, you know, when we pass criminal laws, when we make it illegal to murder, which is what this is doing, we don't have to pass a severability clause along with it because those kinds of laws simply stand. So I think that that statement kind of undermines the argument here about what this bill is really about. And again, I think, though, it's completely unnecessary, and, of course, nobody, few people anywhere would say that a child who's alive and is born doesn't deserve the same protection as any other human being. So, you know, I mean, I think this is just a gotcha bill.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Whalen, for bringing this bill forward. I don't believe that it's a waste of our time at all, and I'm really thankful that you brought this bill forward. And as you were sharing your testimony, and Ms. Rao, too, it's just heartbreaking to me to think of a child that has been aborted and is still alive and is put in a utility closet or anywhere else. And I just really commend you for bringing this forward, and I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you. Members, any further questions? Seeing none. Representative Whalen, any closing comments?
I'll just say thank you again, Madam Chair, for allowing me to be here today to present this bill. Thank you to everyone for your questions and for your support of this bill. I very much appreciate it, and I'm hopeful that we can get this passed.
Okay, members, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1047, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Whalen. Members, the next bill on the calendar is, or on our agenda, excuse me, is House File 606. Representative Keel, welcome to the committee. And members, just to kind of frame our conversation a little bit, we do have a handful of testifiers. We will have Representative Keel present the bill and then go to testifiers. For many of us, not all of us, but many of us around the table, these bills are not foreign. We've had these discussions in the past. And so I will just... we all have a long night ahead of us with the Regents and some other events going on this evening, and so if just kind of framing up the conversation, we're planning on giving this about 45 to 50 minutes if we need to go longer, but I'm trying to be cognizant of other commitments later on in the evening also. So with that, Representative Keel, to your bill, House File 606. And I'm sorry, members, I will move that House File 606 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Keel, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, as our chair indicated, this is a bill that's not foreign to you. It is a bill that licenses requirements for any facility, including an abortion facility that provides outpatient service, a regulation of outpatient service centers. And this would be for centers that do 10 or more abortions in a month. And with that, the only other thing I would express to you, because I would like to hear from our testifiers, is I'm going to share just a little bit of a story. I promised Representative Schumacher I wouldn't be too graphic. I have carried five children and one. It's called a molar pregnancy. So I've been pregnant six times. I have four healthy children and very blessed by that. But I, however, had a spontaneous abortion, a miscarriage. And I live in the country. I live 5 miles in the country, or eight miles in the country. And the five will come up in a second. When I started to have problems, my doctor called me and said, get here now. You don't have much time, knowing where I lived. And I drove in. My husband drove rather fast when he realized it was going to be more serious than that. And long story short, I ended up having DNC. But there were some real complications upon the way. Now, what this has to do with an outpatient is I ended up having a DNC in the hospital. And I'm very thankful that I had the security at a very traumatic time in my life. To know that the facility was safe, that I would be taken care of, the pain that I needed to have handled was, my family was able to be around to help me and support me. But more importantly, there is also an issue that I don't think we talk about very often in all of this. I'm not debating the right to have an abortion, but I am debating the right to make sure that everything is safe, that when someone goes and asks for a procedure to be done, that they know that the clinic is safe, it is clean. It has been licensed, and we don't see the horrible stories that Representative Huntley referred to earlier, and the dangers that can happen. And I think when I look at somebody who's young and vulnerable and may not have any support behind them, it is all that much more important for them to know that where they're going they can trust, and that they can trust for it to be safe. Now, I think in Minnesota we haven't really heard of or seen any concerns. We certainly have had not any problems. But this would help prevent anything from going that direction and make sure that they can count on the safety and this and the protection. I think about the California conversation not long ago where there were procedures done, and I'm sure they thought the tools were clean, and you know, it can be serious in a day and age when we have diseases like MRSA out there that are easily passed to people from one to another. So with that, I have Andrea Rao with me, and I will let her speak.
Ms. Rao, welcome to the committee again, to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. More than 40 years ago, the United States Supreme Court handed down the Roe versus Wade decision. And supporters of that decision were pleased that women would no longer have to engage in dirty, illegal, and unsafe abortions. But how is it then that, as the committee has already at least briefly discussed, that a grand jury report regarding a Pennsylvania abortion facility and the doctor who ran it, Kermit Gosnell, and several of his staff were able to stun our nation, pro-life and pro-choice alike, by shedding light on the dirty, illegal, and unsafe abortions that were happening at that clinic? According to a description of the grand jury report found on the website of the Office of the District Attorney of Philadelphia, quote, Gosnell staffed his decrepit and unsanitary clinic entirely with unlicensed personnel, let them practice medicine on unsuspecting patients, unsupervised, and directed them to heavily drug patients in his absence. In addition, he regularly performed abortions beyond the 24-week limit prescribed by law. As a result, viable babies were born. Gosnell killed them by plunging scissors into their spinal cords, and he taught his staff to do the same. Dirty,
Madam
illegal.
Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I normally do not interrupt a witness, but I really think this is absolutely unnecessary and unrelated to the bill. This story she's telling, you know, sometimes people in this committee, we listen to people's stories all day, and it is not without an impact to listen to, you know, I know every member of this committee hears people with terrible things in their lives. At least we're listening to things that we need to know about legislation we're passing. This we do not need to hear today to discuss this bill. So I would ask you to instruct the witness to please not talk to us about basically murders and illegal activities that have no relationship to the bill in front of us.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Members and to testifiers, it's not lost on any of us that this is an extremely sensitive topic, uncomfortable for many of us to talk about, and certainly some of the practices and methods by which abortions have been conducted in the past are very disturbing, and luckily that's not always the case anymore. But I would ask testifiers to measure their comments in terms of just sensitivity to what we need to hear in this committee and keep it relevant to the bill, to that. Ms. Rao.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as we've mentioned, just to kind of finish that up, and as Representative Mullery had already talked about, Dr. Gosnell, the owner of that facility, is now in jail, and many of his former staff members have been charged with crimes as well. And few people, if any, could argue that this is inappropriate. But the question remains, how did this happen? And more significantly, and this is why I relayed this story, how can we make sure that this never happens here in Minnesota? To the best of our knowledge, no abortion facilities in Minnesota come anywhere near the dirty, illegal, and unsafe conditions that were found at the clinic in Pennsylvania. But we believe that the state should act to ensure that such conditions never do occur here in Minnesota. And this can be done, we believe, by providing common sense licensing and inspection standards for abortion facilities that provide 10 or more abortions per month in Minnesota. The legislation before you today would require such facilities to be licensed by the state and subject to the outpatient surgical center licensure requirements. The state already does such licensing for a number of other facilities, including hospitals, outpatient surgical centers, and many more, even facilities that specialize in body art, like tattoos and piercings. Based on data from 2013, this legislation would affect a maximum of 5 facilities, which between them perform 99% of the almost 10,000 abortions in Minnesota. I would like to share with you the definition of an outpatient surgical center, as defined in Minnesota Rules Chapter 4675, which is the licensing requirements. Outpatient surgical center means a freestanding facility organized for the specific purpose of providing elective outpatient surgery for pre-examined, pre-diagnosed, low-risk patients. Admissions shall be limited to procedures which utilize local or general anesthesia and which do not require overnight inpatient care. It is not organized to provide regular emergency medical services and does not include the physician's and dentist's office or clinic for the practice of medicine or the delivery of primary care. Minnesota's abortion facilities are freestanding facilities. They provide elective outpatient surgery for pre-examined, pre-diagnosed, low-risk patients. Their patients do not require overnight inpatient care. They are not organized to provide regular emergency medical services. How then do they avoid having to abide by outpatient surgery center requirements? They simply call themselves a clinic, like the family practice clinic that I go to, where my doctor, who delivered my 3 children and who for more than a decade has been the primary care physician for me, my husband, and my children, who knows us, who does our annual checkups, has done vaccinations, sick care, and referrals for more serious issues. That's where she works. She works in a clinic. Though I'm guessing that her clinic probably wouldn't have a big problem abiding by the outpatient surgical center requirements either. But we have a long-standing relationship, and she knows us, and she knows her patients. There is a doctor-patient relationship. But simply put, abortion facilities act more like an outpatient surgical facility than they do as a clinic, and it's time that they're regulated as such. To protect the women of the state of Minnesota from the dirty, illegal, and unsafe abortion practices that we have seen in other states, we urge you to support House File 606. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. To our testifiers, I will first call Dan Pollack, who is the Deputy Commissioner from the Minnesota Department of Health. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dan Pollack, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health. I appreciate the opportunity to present the department's position on House File 606. I did just want to clarify that Commissioner Ellinger is in Washington, D.C. this week. He is serving as the acting president of the National Organization for State Health Commissioners and can't be here. I want to take a personal moment just to acknowledge that this bill is bipartisan, and I, as a former House staff person, have worked with members on both sides of this issue. I know it can be contentious and emotional. I know that every legislator engaged on this takes it really seriously and is doing what they believe can best protect the health and safety of their constituents. The Department of Health is engaged in a wide variety of activities aimed at protecting and improving the health of Minnesotans in every community and ensuring that safe conditions exist in 4,760 different healthcare facilities and providing a timely response to more than 20,000 maltreatment allegations annually. House File 606 applies our existing state rules regarding regulation and licensure of ambulatory surgery centers to clinics that perform abortion services. the bill's kind of already been described, so I'll try to skip over some of the details of how it's laid out. Minnesota's 1,250 other similar clinics that do provide similar non-abortion services would not be included by the bill. I do want to clarify, Section 145.416 of current law already directs the Commissioner of Health to license and regulate facilities providing abortion services. The history of that law is that we are unable to operationalize any rulemaking on it because we are under permanent injunction issued by a federal district court in 1977. Now, that case law has been relitigated in other states more recently. I'm going to defer to House Research to give you more case law background on where the circuit splits are, because I don't think it's germane to the department's views, but it might be useful for you to look at that. Aside from constitutional uncertainty, our agency does not support the policy of expanding the ambulatory surgical center rules to a few selected outpatient clinics based solely on one type of service provided. Clinics do not need a specific state license to operate currently, but they are subject to significant oversight in law. Nurses and physicians are licensed under respective health licensing boards, the Board of Medical Practice and the Board of Nursing. Federal clinical lab improvement amendments set standards for clinical laboratories. They're subject to OSHA requirements under federal law. They're subject to local building codes for life safety and fire safety. And health insurers also inspect clinics as part of the in-network contracting process. And then the physical plant requirements in our surgical center rules basically are more stringent than what we view as necessary for ensuring safety or protection of patients in clinical settings. Alternatively, we would say that if there are patient safety concerns, and there may be significant ones, with regards to clinic activities, we should improve safety and standards for all clinic standards, for all clinic activities, and not just a select few procedures. Lastly, I did want to raise just some technical issues with the bill. The way that it's currently drafted actually disallows MDH from conducting more than two inspections or investigations per year, and that would be unusual and a little bit out of step with how we normally do ambulatory surgical center inspections. That would be a serious challenge if there were multiple complaints in 1 year. The fee is set at $3,712 per facility, which does align with ambulatory surgical center fees. That doesn't align with the bill's appropriation of $63,000, and I understand if that's something that the Finance Committee may want to deal with. And then lastly, I did want to just highlight that that section of our rules that currently defines ambulatory surgical centers excludes physician, dentist office, and clinics for delivery of primary care. So you may want to rewrite that section of rule as part of this bill, or at least consider rewriting that to clarify whether you want primary care to still take place at these clinics. And then lastly, I do respectfully remind the committee that a bill identical to this one was vetoed by Governor Dayton in 2012 based on the concerns that I've outlined. Our technical staff is here. We're happy to answer questions, provide additional information, and I thank you for the committee's time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Pollack, and I assume you'll be around for questions when we get to questions from members, if that's okay. So we'll take our next testifier, who is Andrea Ledger, and then the next on deck will be Jane Lane. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Ledger. I'm the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. We represent more than 60,000 Minnesotans throughout the state, and our mission is to guarantee that every woman has the ability to make personal decisions regarding the full range of reproductive choices, including legal abortion, preventing unintended pregnancy, and bearing healthy children. I'm here to testify against House File 606. Contrary to the stated goals of this bill, excessive regulation of abortion providers is not medically justified and will not improve patient care. Abortion is an extremely safe procedure. The state of Minnesota annually publishes a report on induced abortions in Minnesota. For 2013, the most recent year where we have data available, the complication rate for abortion was 0.007%, an extremely small rate, making abortion safer than appendectomies. The 2013 complication rate is nearly half of an already small rate of reported complications in 2011. Further, research confirms that the risk of death from abortion is lower than from a shot of penicillin. Unnecessary and burdensome regulations can often make abortion even less safe for patients. A 2011 analysis in the New England Journal of Medicine, a healthcare economist studied state laws regarding abortion clinics and concluded that restrictions aimed at shutting down clinics or supply-side policies had little effect on demand for abortion. Instead, they either forced women to travel further to obtain health care or denied those with the fewest resources the ability to access wanted services. The study predicts that, quote, making access to abortion unnecessarily costly will probably result in clandestine abortions and unintended childbearing among families with the least resources and the fewest options. A further concern to NARAL is the bill's requirement that the Department of Health inspect clinics without notice, a provision that singles out providers of abortion. According to Minnesota statute, other clinics licensed as outpatient surgical centers are subject to inspection, but with notice, allowing those centers to prepare for protecting patient privacy. To be clear, NARAL does not oppose reasonable provider inspections. However, adequate safeguards must be in place to protect confidential patient records and patient privacy. A further concern, this bill does not specify whether clinic activities may be disrupted during inspection. Patients shouldn't suffer a decrease in quality of care because an inspection is happening. This bill singles out abortion providers and creates rigid, unreasonable standards that do not protect patient safety. I ask you to vote no on House File 606, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Ledger. We'll take our next testifier, but certainly if there's questions for her, Ms. Ledger will be around. Next, we have Jane Lane. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and honored members of the House. My name is Jane Lane, and I am here before you today representing many aspects of the person that I am. I'm the administrator for Whole Woman's Health of the Twin Cities, a local abortion provider, and the board chair of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota Foundation. But primarily, I'm a woman of childbearing years who lives, works, and votes in the state of Minnesota. It is clear to me that some lawmakers in this country and in this state do not value health care in the same way that I do, which is as a fundamental human right. These individuals want you to believe that it is a privilege to obtain care for the full spectrum of your life. Access to safe, legal abortion care is a fundamental part of women's health care. I'm going to say that again. Access to abortion is a fundamental part of health care. Enacting laws that restrict or hinder access to abortion is as detrimental to a woman's life as removing her access to a cardiologist if she's having heart problems. As women, we experience pregnancy with our whole being. Abortion is an extremely safe procedure that rarely requires emergency care. It is 14 times safer than childbirth. In a large-scale recent study, researchers concluded that less than 0.25% of abortions resulted in a major complication. Another recent study found that the rate of major complications for first trimester abortion patients is even lower, with less than 0.05% of patients requiring emergency hospital care. Both the mortality and morbidity rate associated with abortion are markedly lower than that associated with continuing a pregnancy to term. The actual medical practice of abortion requires no incision and in many cases does not even require sedation. With this information, I am wondering why our elected officials are so eager to enforce costly and prohibitive policies on something that is already quite safe. A similar provision to H.R. 606 passed in the state of Texas in 2013, where the company I work for is based out of. When our Texas clinics looked into moving into ambulatory surgical centers, we were faced with a $2 million price tag per location or up to $40,000 per month in additional facility fees. This is an absolutely outrageous cost for a change that does nothing to actually improve the safety of an already safe procedure or the quality of patient-centered care we pride ourselves in giving. Instead, what we have seen is that the state of Texas is now a desert for quality abortion care and has compromised the health and safety of Texas women. We do not want what is happening in Texas to happen in the state of Minnesota. Even more, abortion clinics already comply with the state licensing requirements and are subject to state inspection. Minnesota has existing laws in place that regulate our standards of practice, to which we happily comply. Minnesota has some of the best medical care in the United States. These medically unnecessary and unreasonable bills are a solution to a problem that does not exist. As a Minnesotan and a woman, I implore you to respect my right to self-determination and autonomy and stop threatening health care as a privilege when it is a human right that should be accessible to all. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lane. Our next testifier is Lori Cassie. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Lori Casey, and I am the Executive Director of Women's Health Center in Duluth. WHC was established in 1981 and is the only first trimester abortion clinic north of the Twin Cities. We provide a full range of reproductive and sexual health care to individuals in 20 counties in greater Minnesota. In 2014, 432 women received pregnancy termination services and 468 individuals accessed reproductive health care. I'm speaking in opposition to House File 606. This bill is not about women's health. This bill is about restricting access to abortion. Abortion is an extremely safe medical procedure. Less than 0.3% of abortion patients in the United States experience a complication that requires hospitalization. Nearly all U.S. abortions take place in non-hospital settings, and according to the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, providing abortions in the context of private practice is entirely appropriate, as long as physicians who do so in their offices are equipped to handle any emergencies that arise. A patient's health and safety is Women's Health Center's number one priority, and our complication rate is less than 1%. Mandating unnecessary building requirements does not increase the safety of abortion. This bill's costly requirements to meet the standards of an ambulatory surgical center would force our clinic to close, impacting direct medical services to 1,000 clients in northeastern Minnesota. We estimate that it would cost over $800,000 to renovate our existing building and clinical space. Women's Health Center does not make a profit on abortion services, and we cannot sustain such a costly state requirement. 95% of Minnesota counties have no abortion provider. If Women's Health Center is forced to close, women in greater Minnesota, especially low-income and at-risk women, will suffer the burden of lack of access to an abortion provider. Northeastern women will be barred from safe abortion care due to the costs associated with traveling long distances, geographic isolation, severe winter weather conditions, and the lack of public transportation. These barriers may lead women to seek unsafe alternatives, leading us back to the days before Roe v. Wade, when abortion was the leading cause of maternal mortality in America. In closing, I urge you to oppose House File 606. Outstate women will not be served by this bill, although the women from the metro area will still be able to obtain safe abortion care. This will not be true for greater Minnesota women. Access to abortion services must remain open. Thank you.
Thank you so much for making the commute to be here today. Members, is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify? Okay. If you could come forward and introduce yourself. And we're allowing testifiers about 2 to 3 minutes. Introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Rachel Hall, and I'm a representative of Students for Life. And I'm here in support of the bill. The abortion industry profits immensely from abortions, which is why they are putting profit ahead of safety and opposing common sense license requirements. Whenever these requirements are imposed on outpatient surgical facilities that do not perform abortions, there are no protests from outside groups that it imposes an undue burden on women to get outpatient surgical procedures. Only when imposed on abortion clinics do so-called women's rights groups get upset about abortion access, not the fact that the regulations seek to protect women. Planned Parenthood, the nation's largest abortion provider, did over 327,000 abortions in 2013-2014 and raked in over $1 billion. If they are forced to shut down clinics over standard licensure regulations, they will lose a lot of money. Pregnant women and their preborn babies are nothing but dollar signs to the abortion industry. They will readily choose making a profit over making sure they protect women's health and safety. And so I ask you to vote in favor of the bill.
Thank you for being here. Members, I believe at this point we're going to take up some amendments that you have in your packets. First up, we have the A2 amendment. I'm not sure who is moving that amendment, but if members want to take it out of their packets.
Madam Chair, that would be me.
Okay. Representative Mason moves the A2 amendment. To the amendment, Representative Mason.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I have had three children, so I do know about pregnancy. I do know about delivery and all of those issues. This bill clearly is not about women's safety. It singles out a specific women's health care procedure done at specific clinics. Abortion is, you've already heard, is one of the safest medical procedures performed in the United States. The CDC and other national research centers have determined that abortion has over a 99% safety record. With such a clear track record of safety, this bill accomplishes nothing to improve safety or health outcomes. Our own medical, Minnesota Medical Association sent a strongly worded letter opposing this bill, and that should be in your packet. Two of the sentences that you might see is there is no specific patient safety measure addressed under this bill. The legislation could interfere with the provision of care for pregnant women. In short, Minnesota medical professionals, the ones who should be making health care decisions, not Republican legislators, they are opposed to this bill. Women and men currently.
Excuse me, Representative Mason. Representative Dean?
Madam Chair, Representative Mason, I think you probably want to correct yourself on that last one.
I beg your pardon?
Representative Dean?
This is a bipartisan bill. It always has been. Representative Mason.
Okay.
Representative Mason.
Out those two words. Women and men currently receive a wide range of outpatient surgical procedures, vasectomies, litigations, amputations, dental surgery, etc., at Minnesota's excellent health care clinics, all of which are currently regulated the same way through the individual physician's medical license. If we're about protecting the safety of Minnesotans, let's extend that requirement to license all health care clinics as outpatient surgical centers rather than needlessly singling out one type of very safe legal health care procedure. With that, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A3 amendment, which includes the fact that all clinics need to be treated the same.
And Representative Mason, I think you, I just want to clarify, I think you mean the A2 amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Nope, that's okay. So Representative Mason moves the A2 amendment. Representative Keel, to the amendment.
I would not want to accept this amendment. The idea is that we are making sure the clinics are safe. And I would beg to disagree that they're all the same, because a regular clinic, when I go in to have a procedure done of some sort, I have developed a good relationship with a doctor that I will now be asking to do another procedure. We have a relationship. We know exactly my health issues. I actually have a cousin, young, she's my children's age, that had some issues, and she had a blood clot problem. And they would not have known that had she not worked with her regular doctor. And it could have been serious. It was a little bit life-threatening. She ended up in the hospital. But my concern here is that the clinics all have, whether you're doing if you're doing a vasectomy or a tubal ligation or I can think of 101 procedures that you do in an outpatient situation. I want to know that they're done safely, that there isn't a disease problem, that I'm supported by doctors that know, doctors and nurses that I have a relationship with, so that they know if there's a problem. I guess in rural Minnesota we would talk about who we would contact if there was a problem. But you would do that anywhere. You would know who to contact, and those relationships need to happen. And
Representative Mason?
If I'm listening correctly, that would be what you're saying is all clinics should be included in your bill then.
Representative Keel?
Yes, if they're providing procedures, they should make sure that they are safe.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, we request a roll call on this.
Okay,
Representative. On the amendment and the bill.
Okay, Representative Mulry requests a roll call on the 8-2 amendment as well as final passage of the bill. Representative Mulry. Okay. Members, any other comments or questions? Representative Klomp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What increase in scope, what quantity of clinics, what style of care procedures, et cetera, does this expand the bill?
Representative Mason, I don't want to answer for you. My understanding as I read this is all clinics as defined under the Minnesota rule listed, which I understand to be all clinics that have a medical provider in them. If that's incorrect, Representative Mason, you can correct me. Representative Klom.
Thank you. I understand that an ophthalmologist, a dentist, there are many types of medical providers. Is this meaning to be all facilities that have a certain level of medical, participant? Your thing didn't clarify sufficiently for me.
Okay. Well, Representative Mason, to your amendment.
Okay. I just, again, if you look at the bill, it's everybody that we're trying to create a level playing field for all clinics, period. So rather than this bill is just picking out maybe a half a dozen in the state. And it makes no sense to me.
Representative Klom.
Madam Chair, again, my question was, you said basically all clinics means what? Part of the definition I was hearing was that they've got a medical professional. Well, I see a dentist as being a medical professional. I see anywhere you go to have your eyes examined that has a a doctor. So I'm trying to understand, are these included, yes or no? The ambiguity of the answer didn't clarify my query.
Representative Klum, we can maybe ask House Research, but my understanding is it would include all of those.
Okay.
Yes. Ms. Olson, if you could shed light, or if I am wrong, please fix that.
Madam Chair, Representative Klum, I'm trying to look up the specific rule right now to read you the definition, but unfortunately technology is not being my friend, and I can only read half of it. So if you would give me a moment, I can certainly get you that definition.
Sure. We can wait a second. And I will just say briefly, my understanding of the bill and part of the goal at getting at this is the type of procedure, and that the way that in Chapter 4675, the Department of Health, where it talks about what outlines an outpatient surgical procedure, that an abortion hits the criteria on many of those. And so the interest is in bringing it more in line with what would be considered an outpatient surgical procedure and the standards that by which the state licensed those. And so to that point, this amendment would grossly expand the intention of this bill, and that is to try to understand that abortion is much more like an outpatient procedural, outpatient surgical procedure than it is going into your ophthalmologist or your dentist. It's more surgical in nature. It's intrusive, and that's what we're trying to get at. And so, yes, Representative Mulry.
Madam Chair, to that point, there's actually some of the things that are just covered by medical clinics are much more invasive than the abortion procedure. So it would be picking up. Right now we would be putting in something that's far less invasive than some things that aren't licensed as a clinic. So it works both ways.
Well, and thank you, Representative Mulry. And I do follow your line of thinking. I do think one of the other unique piece of this that falls in line with an outpatient surgical center and other things that are licensed, and I believe Representative Keel alluded to this, but is that it tends to be a one-time interaction. Many of our clinics that provide primary care and things like that, it tends to be an ongoing relationship. And so while that's not necessarily spelled out in statute or rulemaking, I do think it's a consideration on this issue. Representative Mulry.
Madam Chair, and that issue is covered by the fact that these doctors doing it and the nurses are regulated by their board. So, when I have a relationship with my doctor and my nurses, but they are all regulated. They're licensed and regulated by boards, so the fact that I have a relationship with them is already covered.
Members, any further questions on the A2 amendment? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. We're waiting for a clarification on the Minnesota rule referenced. I will just say that I don't think relationships make the difference, and I'll just say for most people or many people in the metro area, your employer may change health plans regularly, even if you're in the same clinic. You have practitioners who are laid off, who switch to different locations in the system as they climb the ladder, whatever. And most people, when they're undergoing a specialized procedure, go to a specialist. You don't usually look to develop a long-term relationship with a specialist. It's usually something has occurred in your life that makes you want to seek out some specialized care. And so, but I think the issue is we've already had a previous attempt at a specialty licensure just for this facility, challenged in court and had a federal court rule against it. And now we're once again being asked to look at an issue that the courts have already given us guidance on, and for a particular procedure rather than the setting in which and the risk to the patient of the procedures that take place. And I think it's fair to, if we're really concerned about patient safety, that we ought to be as concerned about a patient who's undergoing any kind of procedure and rank those on the risk to the patient in terms of prioritizing our regulatory authority. But not the relationship we have with the provider. That's, you know, people who live in small rural communities with a stable healthcare workforce have more ability to have long-term relationships than some. But I think everyone tends to go to specialists.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Briefly to that point, Ms. Rao?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I just wanted to point out that there are a small number of abortions that take place outside of the five major abortion facilities. And those, we assume, generally take place in a regular doctor's clinic, probably with somebody who is seeing their regular physician. And that physician decides to do the abortion themselves rather than referring them to an abortion facility. And we aren't seeking to regulate those because that is how most clinics in our state are treated. Now, I would like to kind of turn the argument on its head a little bit from what I have heard a number of the members of the committee say, and say, you know, in other procedures where the only reason for going to a particular facility is a one-time surgery, and you go there for that one procedure, you get a referral there maybe, or you just go because you know that they do it and that's it. It's a one-time surgery. And in those cases, you go to a licensed outpatient surgical facility. And so why is it that we treat abortion differently? We're not looking to treat abortion differently at this point. We're looking to treat abortion the same as we treat other procedures of a similar nature that take place in locations similar to what we do for other outpatient surgical procedures.
Ms. Olson, if you want to briefly give that description, then we have Representative Dean, and then we'll go to a vote.
Madam Chair, members, the particular rule that is referenced in the amendment refers to a clinic as an operational entity through which personal clinicians and local trade area clinicians deliver healthcare services. And in this section of rural healthcare services is not defined, but a personal clinician and local trade area clinician are both defined as a physician assistant, or an advanced practice registered nurse. So it would be limited to those three.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, saw the Department of Health coming up, and, you know, I just think the amendment is not a serious amendment. I think the author of the amendment doesn't want this particular law to be subjected to all of the doctor's offices around the state of Minnesota, whether or not they do surgery. I hope the author is not serious about that, and I don't think that the author is. So we should vote it down. But when I go to the Department of Health website, and if I wanted to open up a surgical center, I would have to pay a fee of $3,700. So there is a fee that would be collected by the department. And it says outpatient surgical centers is organized for the specific purpose of providing elective outpatient surgery for pre-examined, pre-diagnosed low-risk patients. Admissions are limited to procedures in which utilize local or general anesthesia and which do not require overnight inpatient care. And it would seem to me that this would fit exactly within that scope. It would be very similar to getting an arthroscopic knee surgery or something else that we routinely see in the state of Minnesota in the outpatient surgical centers that provide convenient and safe outpatient surgical procedures. Would be billed as such if it were in a hospital or in an outpatient surgical center. That's how they get billed. Would seem to me that would fit very, very precisely within the Department of Health's own definition of outpatient surgical centers. So it's strange to me that it's not currently the law. So it would be for that reason that I would oppose the amendment. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Representative Mason, final word on your amendment.
Thank you. Maybe we could have House Research do a little bit of defining as well, but my understanding is typically when the abortions are performed, they are not considered surgery if they're done early on. Is that correct?
Ms. Olson.
Madam Chair and Representative Mason, I would have to look into that. I'm not sure if surgery is specifically defined anywhere.
Here's a computer.
I don't know if the Department of Health has anything to say on that.
Welcome to the committee. If you could speak to that issue. Introduce yourself, excuse me.
Madam Chair, Manny Munson-Ogala, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health. Surgery is defined under the rules, but I suspect it probably will not help answer our questions in a definitive way. I will find the definition here. Why, thank you.
You're welcome.
So under 465.0100 definitions, subpart 9, surgery. Surgery for the purpose of parts 4675.0100 to 4675.2800 means treatment of condition by operative means involving incision or repair of human tissues. A quick note, those rules were written in 1991, so as you can imagine, the state of medical practice has advanced quite a bit since that time. We have staff who were small people in 1991 and can't explain the basis for that definition, but that's the definition we have.
Thank you for offering some levity. That is appreciated. Members, I think we can, Representative Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I wasn't going to speak on this amendment, but Representative Dean says it's not a serious amendment. And I would say in response to that, it's not a serious bill. You know, we have not heard one shred of evidence that any woman in the state of Minnesota has her health endangered by the lack of licensing of clinics where they do abortion procedures. And I usually expect a lot of the GOP members and maybe even some of the DFL members to, you know, I usually hear that we don't want unnecessary regulations in the state. Usually we try to regulate only in response to some real need, and there's no need shown here. So I don't even know how to vote on this amendment, to tell you the truth, because frankly I don't think we need the amendment, but again, I don't think we need the bill. But certainly, you know, sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If we need this bill, to show to protect against some unshown harm, then we probably need the amendment to protect against other unrecognized harm.
Okay, members, we will have a roll call on the vote. So with that, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mack.
No.
Vice Chair Peterson.
No.
DFL Lead Mullery.
Aye.
Representative Albright.
No.
Representative Allen.
Yes.
Representative Backer.
No.
Representative Baker.
No.
Representative Dean.
Nope.
Representative Fisher.
Yes.
Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Kelly.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes.
Representative Lummer.
No.
Representative Mason.
Yes.
Representative Moran.
Yes.
Representative Pearson.
No.
Representative Quam.
Yeah.
Representative Schumacher.
No.
Representative Schultz.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas is unavailable.
Members, there being 10 ayes and, excuse me one second, just a minute.
Or nine.
Members, there being 9 ayes and 12 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Members, we have the A3 amendment. Who is moving the A3? Representative Mullery moves the A3.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move it and also ask for roll call on it. And basically, this amendment, we are adding a huge cost to some of the clinics, and I think it's really important to protect the women in this state, and also the issue of equality comes in, and there are U.S. Supreme Court decisions that if you put conditions around abortion clinics that affect the access of women, the affordability, anything like that, the distance they have to travel, that is then unconstitutional. So even if the author wants to make this a constitutional bill, I think they would have to do that, this amendment, because there are serious questions as to whether the, especially the outstate clinic, will remain open. And if not, it would be a tremendous burden on a great many women in Minnesota who are pregnant or thinking of even becoming that. And so I think that It's very simple. We're requesting a lot extra from them that's not really needed. And in order for this to remain, if this bill did become law, which I'm pretty sure it won't, we have to protect the women of the state to their rights under the U.S. Constitution and the state constitution. And I don't think that's done unless we do the necessary funding for them to comply with this change.
We'll first go to Representative Keel to the amendment.
Madam Chair, members, I would not accept this amendment. Do not feel that it's, I find it very odd that we listen to a cat and breeder dog breeder bill last year, and we didn't offer to pay for any of their upgrades. And now we're talking about, we passed all of that, and it, I just,
well, maybe
you can ask. Yeah,
I'll leave it at that.
Question from Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would the author of the amendment please clarify for me what are the deficiencies that are present that are racking up this very large number? If you could enumerate some of those deficiencies justifying the numbers in this amendment.
Representative Mulry.
I'm sorry. Representative Quam, or you repeat the question.
I think Representative Quam was just asking for some explanation behind the dollar amount provided in the amendment. Representative Mulry.
Well, Madam Chair, we got the cost of $800,000 just for one of the clinics, and is it five? I believe there are.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The actual question was, can you enumerate in the deficiencies that are generating this cost? Obviously, if they are deficient to meet a standard and as a cost, you know what those deficiencies are, and please, you know, let us know what those deficiencies are.
Representative Murray.
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, you know that I don't know every deficiency in every clinic, and you wouldn't know them on any bill that you're carrying. I assume that the one testifier has estimates of what the costs are, but I certainly don't have the estimates of the costs all over the state.
Members, other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not an expert on this, but my understanding is that to meet those requirements, one would have to have men's and women's restrooms off of the waiting room. One would have to have a certain width of hallways. One needs, you know, it's a burden that has not shown itself to be necessary for those who have been providing this service for the, you know, ever since Roe v. Wade. But the requirement and the standard that's put here is really designed for a much more broad-based patient load with both sexes and a much higher volume than most of these facilities would see. And so my understanding is that those are the type of physical things that don't have anything to do with the actual physical, you know, the care that is being delivered. It's more about the physical plant itself. And that has to do more with the size and the volume of the people you're serving.
And members, I would also point out in terms, the dollar amount is provided, but there is a little bit of ambiguity in terms of total cost on line 1.8 and 1.9 of the bill. It does say the funding is available until expended or all facilities have been issued a sufficient grant to cover costs. I would, I guess, express some concerns over the open-endedness of that in terms of the expenditure to the state and the use of the word issued a sufficient grant. Who determines what is sufficient and if it has to cover 100% of costs, a certain percentage. It's a bit ambiguous on that. But members, I would just express my own concern over this particular amendment. We discuss a lot of issues around licensure and the burden that's going to put on whoever we may or may not be licensing, whatever facility we may or may not be proposing to license. Many of us have sat through many of those hearings, but rarely do we see a proposal that would suggest that we have to cover the cost of bringing these private entities up to speed to pay for the licensure that we're asking them to live up to based on what we think as a state imposes whatever we think, whether it's safety or regulatory reform. And so I would see this as being out of line with what we typically do here at the legislature. Other comments? Representative Mulry.
One huge issue on that, what you just said, is that normally we're not talking about a constitutionality issue, which is very much, and I know I'm sure the author and her main witness know that that's a huge challenge in this issue.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If the witness from Lori Casey could come forward and maybe highlight some of the costs that her clinic would be exposed to if this bill was passed, what she would have to do to modify her clinic, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, committee members, we would probably have to upgrade our heating and ventilation system. We would have to move walls, reconfigure our clinic space. Right now, our hallways are adequate. We probably are 1 inch less than what's recommended. We would need to add plumbing facilities. We would try to in our building get extra space so we could accommodate a men's and women's restroom in our waiting area. And we'd have to replace flooring. So there's a lot of just physical, structural things that we would have to do.
Thank you, Ms. Casey. Members, Representative Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'd just like to kind of respond to your contention that we don't do this for private entities. In fact, we fund nonprofits all the time for all kinds of things. And in this case, these providers are providing a legal and, for many women, necessary, in their estimation, certainly necessary health care service. And this bill is requiring them to spend quite a bit of money to be able to continue providing that service. So, you know, I think that we do, in fact, fund a lot of nonprofits. We certainly give a lot of grants out to help different kinds of health providers provide health care that they need to be providing. And, in fact, we just funded a deficiency bill that the Department of Health put forward where they had enlisted a lot of healthcare providers to help in the fight against Ebola, and we funded a deficiency for that, having enlisted these private entities and said, you partner with us to provide needed services, we're going to pay you for that, make sure that you're reimbursed at least a good share of your costs after the fact. So I think it's entirely appropriate if this legislature, in fact, wants to require these providers to jump through a bunch of hoops and spend a lot of money in order to continue providing services that they now are providing just fine, thank you very much. They're not complaining that they need to upgrade, where this committee is coming in, probably passing this bill and saying you need to make these changes, then it's very appropriate for us to fund it.
Members, any further comments? Okay, with that, to the A3 amendment, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mack?
No.
Vice Chair Peterson?
No.
DFL Lead Mullery?
Aye.
Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Allen?
Yes.
Representative Backer?
No.
Representative Baker?
No.
Representative Dean?
Nope.
Representative Fisher?
Yes.
Representative Franson?
No.
Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Kelly?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Lummer?
No.
Representative Mason?
Yes.
What?
Sorry. Yes.
Yes. Representative Moran?
Yes.
Representative Pearson?
No.
Representative Quam?
Nine.
Representative Schumacher?
No.
Representative Schultz?
Yes.
Member, there being 9 ayes and 12 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Members, to the bill. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two sentences. I believe that this bill is clearly not needed and is an unconstitutional interference with the important right to women that's guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution and our Constitution. And I think very important to this is one sentence from Minnesota Medical Association, that they're concerned that the adoption of this legislation could interfere with the provision of care for pregnant women. I think that I don't want to go into repeating all of the good testimony, especially from the department.
Representative Keel, closing comments on your bill.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Representative Freiberg, you were on the list.
Yes, thank you. I have a series of questions for the bill author.
Okay. Representative Freiberg.
Sure. On line 1.9, it says that this provision applies to facilities that provide 10 or more of those of these procedures, and I'm wondering why that number was chosen and why these provisions should apply to facilities that do 10 of them and not but not to 9, and the ones that do 9.
Representative Keel, or excuse me, Ms. Rao.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg, and members of the committee. Admittedly, the number 10 is somewhat arbitrary. Other states, I believe, have used it as well. Although in Minnesota, if you look at the facilities that provide abortion services, there's a very distinct difference between those that provide a number of services and those that, you know, provide like one a year. And so 10 is a fairly arbitrary number. If the committee felt strongly about changing that to another, you know, appropriate arbitrary number, we'd be open to discussing that. But we think that this encompasses the abortion facilities here in the state.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 1.24, it says that sanctions provided in this subdivision do not restrict other available sanctions. I'm just wondering if the bill author could give me an example of what those other available sanctions might be.
Representative Keel. Ms. Rao.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg, off the top of my head, I'm not sure. I think that seems like an appropriate thing to discuss in what I assume is going to be the next committee, and we'll be happy to discuss that further then.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 2.9, it says that the licensure fee under this section is $3,712. I'm wondering why that particular number was chosen.
Mm-hmm. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Freiberg, I believe that is the dollar amount that is required for outpatient clinic services now for licensure.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 2.14, it says that any of these facilities have to follow Minnesota Rules Chapter 4675. By adopting this, we would be incorporating all of those rules, and there are many of them. I just glanced at several of them while we were discussing this. We would be incorporating all of those rules, so I think it's appropriate to ask about them. Just to take one for example here, Rule 4675.1800 deals with air filter efficiencies. It says that all filter efficiencies shall be certified by an independent testing agency and shall be based on ASHRAE standard number 52-68, except as noted in 7-30D-2-1, paragraph 2. And I'm just wondering why it is important to apply ASHRAE standard number 52-68, except as noted, as I mentioned, to these facilities, but not to facilities that provide vasectomies, dental surgery, or amputations.
Representative Keel.
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer, ask the department to answer the difference, please.
I think we're going to phone a friend.
There are specific requirements.
Yeah.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself.
Thank you. Maria King with the Department of Health. I'm an assistant program manager. I actually can't speak to the specific ASHRAE. I think what you're looking at are the recommendations for probably the relative humidity and that type of thing that do have specific requirements, and those are actually spelled out in the licensure. And also we use the AORN standards is what we impose for the requirements for facilities that are freestanding outpatient surgical centers. Does that answer the question?
All right. Thank you.
Yes, it does. Thank you for your help.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, members, any further questions? Representative Keel, one brief closing comment on your bill.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just want to remind people that really the goal here is, and I know not all of us believe that, but the goal really is to make sure that a young female, young or old, doesn't matter what age, they're seeking an abortion, they are able to be assured that it will be safe, that they will be cared for. I find this argument of even the bathroom, I'm thinking, if I had a support system come with me, which I would hope you would, because there are not very many procedures, surgical, that you don't have, they don't require a family member or somebody has to take you home. And we don't have a bathroom for a male in that facility, is what I'm understanding. And that support system should be there, whether male or female, to help that young person or that person who's having a procedure done, period. But I want to remind you the goal is really to make sure that women can expect good care. I don't want to find out we've ignored this, we've walked away from it, and 5 years down the road we find that someone or multiple women have had serious problems and hopefully, never a death, but this is very concerning. So with that, I would ask you to think about this and the consequences of what if we don't do something, and I would appreciate your support on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Members, there is a roll call on the bill, and so the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mack.
Yes.
Vice Chair Peterson.
Yes.
Mallory.
No.
Albright.
Yes.
Allen.
No.
Thacker.
Yes.
Baker.
Aye.
Dean.
Yes.
Fisher.
No.
Franson.
Yes.
Freiberg.
No.
Kelly.
Aye.
Rubin.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Mohner.
Yes.
Mason.
No.
Moran.
No.
Pearson.
Yes.
Plum.
See.
Schumacher.
Yep.
Schultz.
No. Members, there being 12 ayes and 9 noes, the motion prevails, and House File 606 is re-referred to the Committee on State Government Operations. Members, we have one more bill on the agenda. However, we are going to recess for about 10 minutes. We have to move to room 10, at which point we will promptly take up the last bill of the day. And so, members, with that, I will move to recess and start up at 4:35. With that... Okay, members, we will get back to work here, and so our next bill is going to be House File 607, and I will move that House File 607 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And we have Representative Tice and Representative Pugh. If you guys could present your bill, and we will go from there. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Cindy Pugh, second-term state representative representing House District 33B. Serving Chanhassen and the greater area around Lake Minnetonka. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for hearing my simple and straightforward bill, House File 787, which would bring an end to taxpayer-funded abortion.
I'm sorry, Representative Pugh. I'll just clarify, too, for members in audience. Representative Tice and Representative Pugh have identical bills, and so just for members members, we're working off of House File 606, and I'm sorry, 607, excuse me, and that is also the bill that Representative Pugh is speaking to, just so there's no confusion. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the many co-authors who have signed on to my bill, including Representatives Dean, Shoemaker, Baker, and Chair Mack, who all serve on this committee. The debate goes on about abortion, whether it's right or wrong, whether it's ethical or unethical, and more. My bill does not address this very controversial issue. What my bill does do is speak to whether taxpayers should be required to subsidize the practice. It appears to me, based on my having reviewed the statistics, that abortion has become a bit of an industry in Minnesota, and taxpayers are footing one-third of the bill. As a second-term state legislator representing one of the highest tax districts in the state, I've become increasingly sensitive to the many ways my constituents have been burdened by taxation, and sadly, the impact that high taxes have had and have inflicted upon the hardworking families throughout my district. Since 2012, I have been engaged with constituents throughout my district, and when this subject matter has come up, and it has frequently come up, I found the common ground, a point on which we can all agree, is that taxpayers should not be expected to pay for abortions. I believe my bill is reflective of the will of the people in my district and would be in a majority of House districts on a bipartisan basis throughout the state of Minnesota. And one final point, just as our legislature has done twice in my brief tenure, specifically regarding taxes, we've worked diligently to achieve federal conformity. My bill would accomplish this regarding abortions. I ask for the committee's support in support of this common sense bill. Our state's hardworking, taxpaying citizens deserve our support. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. Representative Tice, anything you want to add?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I am honored to be here today to bring forward House File 607. I door-knocked a lot of homes in the last several years, and the one question I got most frequently was regarding my pro-life stance, which I was very pleased to say I am pro-life. I believe it is my duty to represent my constituency in challenging and changing our current law. I believe that one place to start is with this bill. My folks are not happy about spending their hard-earned money on elective procedures because of the Minnesota Court's 1995 Doe versus Gomez ruling. Taxpayer-funded abortions have swelled to 34.8% of all abortions performed in the state, according to the Minnesota Department of Health. It is unfortunate that taxpayer-funded abortions have been on the rise in Minnesota in the recent years. As an advocate for my constituents, it is my duty to make some changes. I appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Ms. Rao.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Once again, I hope you aren't too tired of seeing me. I do urge you to pass House File 607. House File 607 would conform Minnesota's policy on abortion with the federal government by reinstating a ban on most taxpayer-funded abortions. In 1978, Minnesota passed a law that prohibited taxpayer-funded abortions, except in cases of rape, incest, and to save the life of the mother, just like the federal government's Hyde Amendment. However, a lower court ruling in June of 1994 struck down that ban, and the Minnesota Supreme Court's 1995 Doe versus Gomez decision established a right to abortion in the Minnesota Constitution, as Roe versus Wade did on the federal level. However, the Gomez decision goes even further by requiring that Minnesota taxpayers be forced to pay for abortions, one of the nation's most extreme policies regarding abortion. As a result, today, a third of all abortions performed in Minnesota are paid for with tax dollars. In most recent years, this amounts to more than $1 million each year. From the time of the court decisions until the end of 2012, taxpayers spent well over $20 million on more than 65,000 abortions. State tax money in Minnesota is used for a lot of good things. It funds our schools, our parks, and our nursing homes. It builds our roads and bridges and helps the underprivileged. But in recent years, our taxpayer dollars have also been diverted for the purpose of killing unborn children. So while the vast majority of state money is arguably used to build a better life for Minnesotans, some tax dollars help to end the lives of Minnesotans. A Marist poll conducted in January of this year found that 68% of Americans oppose taxpayer-funded abortions. This includes 69% of women and 49% of those who self-identify as being pro-choice, all in opposition to taxpayer-funded abortions. This polling is very consistent with what we typically see. Some may argue that it is discriminatory to not provide low-income women with a taxpayer-funded abortion. However, federal courts have disagreed with this notion. In fact, for decades, the federal government has forbidden most taxpayer-funded abortions, just as we seek to do here today. This is not an issue of whether abortion should be legal or illegal, as this bill does not seek to outlaw abortion. It does, however, return the issue of whether or not the taxpayers of this state should be forced to fund a practice which the majority oppose to the policymakers of the state where the decision is rightly decided. A ban on taxpayer funding of abortion is a reasonable measure which should be supported by pro-life and pro-choice advocates alike. Unless we wish to force citizens to fund an act which they do not support and which doesn't further the public good, and do it at a rate of roughly 10 times every day, including weekends, we should all be supporting this common sense legislation that protects and respects our fellow Minnesota citizens. I urge you once again to support House File 607 and would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. We will go to further testifiers at this point. We first have Andrea Ledger. Welcome again to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, nice to be here again. We have the most popular name in the room tonight. Again, I'm Andrea Ledger, Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota, and I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 607 and 787. First, I believe that we can all agree that we want women to be healthy and safe, even if we disagree about abortion. A woman's health insurance should enable her to take care of her health and well-being. When a woman needs to end her pregnancy, by providing health care coverage for abortion, we're helping to ensure that she will be able to see a licensed, quality health provider and get the care that she needs. In the real world, restrictions on abortion access don't eliminate abortion, but they can push women to make the decision later in pregnancy or push abortion out of reach altogether. Low-income women often have difficulty raising the money to pay for abortion care, and research indicates that economic barriers often cause them to obtain abortion care 2 to 3 weeks later in pregnancy than wealthier women. This is especially problematic because the cost of abortion increases the longer the pregnancy continues. This bill would also create profound hardships for women and families across the state, particularly for those who already face significant barriers to receiving high-quality health care, such as low-income women, young women, and women of color. When a woman is living paycheck to paycheck, denying coverage for an abortion can push her deeper into poverty. Indeed, studies show that a woman who seeks an abortion but is denied is 3 times more likely to fall into poverty than one who is able to get an abortion. Finally, when it comes to the most important decisions in life, such as whether to become a parent, it is vital that a woman be able to consider all her options, including an abortion, no matter what her income or her form of insurance. A woman facing an unintended pregnancy should not have to make her health care decisions based on whether she has enough money. It should be based on what is best for her and best for her family. If abortion coverage is available to some, it should be available to all. Simply put, we shouldn't treat some women's health needs differently than others just because of the type of insurance they have. Singling out abortion services for exclusion from state health care plans that cover pregnancy-related care jeopardizes women's health and discriminates against low-income women. I urge you to vote against these bills, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for being here again. Our next testifier is Karen Law. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Karen Law, and I'm the Executive Director of Pro-Choice Resources, a grassroots advocacy and healthcare resource. For over 48 years, Pro-Choice Resources has served women and their families. Clergy and doctors founded our organization as they believed all women should be treated with respect. Our mission is to ensure that all people and communities have the power and resources to make the sexual and reproductive health decisions with self-determination and dignity. We believe that access to all reproductive health care is a basic human right. I'm here today to speak in opposition to House Files 607 and 787. We know that the majority of Minnesotans want our representatives to treat all people with respect and believe that a woman, not politicians, should make the informed decisions when it comes to her own pregnancy. Yet House File 607 and 787 purposely interferes with the woman's personal decision-making. For many, coverage for abortion care means the difference between getting the health care they need and being denied the health, that care. We should not create additional burdens and restrictions that deny health care coverage for someone who is eligible and qualified for Medicaid just to make it impossible for her to have an abortion. I do not understand why we push for these bans when we know these bans will harm Minnesota's most vulnerable women and families. It seems unjust, unfair, and discriminatory. There's a misconception that the bills that have been put forth are to protect women and are in the best interest of our community. Sadly, this couldn't be further from the truth. These bills are thinly veiled pieces of legislation designed to create additional barriers to abortion and push this service out of reach for poor women. At Pro-Choice Resources, we know that communities and families thrive when women are able to make the decisions that are best for themselves and their family. Every day we hear from women who are struggling to make ends meet and who are often overlooked or misrepresented when it comes to the politics of abortion. These women are seeking resources for basic health care. Pregnancy happens in the broader context of our lives, and only the woman knows the full story and circumstances around her decision. For example, a woman that we've served, her name is Becky. Becky is 35 years old and the mother of two children. She has a job where she works 12-hour shifts, but she's never guaranteed a set number of hours per week. It shouldn't matter whether Becky has private or government-funded health insurance. She should have coverage for a full range of pregnancy-related health care, including abortion if she needs it. It's important to provide insurance coverage to ensure that all women will be able to see a licensed, quality health care provider and receive safe care if we truly want to help and protect the women in Minnesota. It makes sense to me that health programs for women with low incomes cover birth control and abortion, not just childbirth, because when people can plan when and if to have children, it's good for them and our society as a whole. I urge this committee to oppose House File 607 and House File 787. Thank you for your time, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you for being here in the committee. Our next testifier is Reverend Abigail Henderson. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee, my name is Reverend Abigail Henderson. I am the Associate Minister of First United Church of Christ in Northfield. I am also on the board of the Minnesota chapter of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, and I would like to speak in opposition of HF 607. I hope that my testimony will remind you that the religious voice is not united against abortion. My words reflect the values of a wide range of clergy and people of faith across Minnesota, and my goal in speaking is not to persuade those who don't agree with me, but rather to lift up a perspective I hope will not be discounted as you consider this bill. Here is where my Christian faith has led me on the subject of abortion. I pray to a loving, forgiving God of grace. I pray to a God who stands with people when they are suffering and when they are faced with difficult decisions, and this includes women who make the decision to end a pregnancy. I pray to a God who understands that human existence is complicated and difficult, and who yearns for us to treat one another with mercy and compassion. I pray to a God who seeks justice, and from my perspective, this means that God calls us to create a world where all people can access legal medical services regardless of race or economic status. Finally, and Perhaps most importantly, I pray to a God who represents my best understanding of what is sacred and good. And I know that many in this room do not share my religious values, especially regarding abortion. I don't want or need to change anyone's personal attitude toward abortion. What I hope and pray for is the day when each and every woman is empowered to make her own reproductive decisions in light of her values and conscience and her own relationship with God. I have arrived at my position on abortion through prayer, discernment, and conversation with people whom I trust. And so I trust other women to do the same when they consider when, how, and if to bear children. Therefore, I cannot support HF 607 because it prohibits state-sponsored health plans from providing abortion coverage. It seems to me that such legislation reflects the viewpoint of a particular religious-based perspective on abortion. Behind this bill, I see a violation of my deeply held religious beliefs, as well as the religious beliefs of countless women across Minnesota. I believe it is not the government's role to make such important, intimate decisions on behalf of women who rely on state-sponsored health insurance. Privileged women can and do exercise their constitutional right to abortion in Minnesota, and I believe that low-income women deserve the same level of dignity and self-determination. So I urge the committee to protect religious freedom and respect all women's dignity as you consider HF 607. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be here. Our final testifier is Raleigh Levine. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Raleigh Levine. I'm a professor of law at the William Mitchell College of Law, and one of my areas of expertise is constitutional law. My statement will focus on why House Files 607 and 787, if they were to become law, would violate the Minnesota Constitution under the precedent set by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1995 in Minnesota in Doe versus Gomez. In that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that a law that allows the use of public funds for childbirth-related medical services but not abortion-related medical services violates a woman's fundamental right of privacy under the Minnesota Constitution. Even were the U.S. Supreme Court to overrule its decision that the federal constitution no longer protects the right to abort pre-viability, the Minnesota Supreme Court's independent decision about what the Minnesota Constitution protects would not change. As the Gomez Court stressed, the federal constitution is a floor, not a ceiling, and states are free to determine that their constitutions are more protective of civil liberties than is the U.S. Constitution. Like Minnesota, several states have decided that funding childbirth-related but not abortion-related medical services violates a state constitutional privacy right. In so holding, our state Supreme Court explained that restricting government funding for abortions often means that poverty-stricken women will not choose childbirth over abortion, which is apparently one of the goals of the law, but rather will simply delay abortion while they seek alternate funding. But delaying an abortion increases the health risk that women face in connection with the procedure, which subverts the very purpose of state-funded health services, which is to alleviate the hardships faced by those who otherwise cannot afford medical treatment. Moreover, those low-income women who do choose to carry their pregnancies to term simply because they have no other feasible financial option have had the exercise of their fundamental right to choose discouraged just as effectively as if their right to abort had been denied outright. The funding denial thus constitutes an infringement on the fundamental right to privacy. Because the discriminatory health care funding at issue in House Files 607 and 787 infringes on the fundamental right to privacy, the state may enact such discriminatory measures only when it can demonstrate that it has a compelling interest, not just a legitimate interest in doing so. It could not demonstrate such an interest in Gomez, and it cannot do so now. Neither an interest in protecting potential human life nor an interest in encouraging and supporting childbirth is compelling unless and until the fetus is viable, capable of surviving outside the mother's womb. And even then, a mother need not sacrifice her own life for her potential child's. To find that HF 607 and 787 are constitutional then, the Minnesota Supreme Court would have to overrule Gomez, a case that has been the law of this land for 20 years, violating the principle of adhering to precedent, stare decisis. Even though the state Supreme Court's composition has changed since 1995, and even conceding that the Gomez decision is, of course, politically divisive, public disapproval of a logical, well-reasoned decision is not considered a sufficiently compelling reason to overrule it and would violate the stare decisis principle. Thus, I urge you to recognize that were HF 607 and 787 to be enacted as law, the Minnesota Supreme Court would and should strike down that law under our state constitution. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I will remain available for questions.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. We appreciate it. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify to this bill? You can come forward. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. And if you could keep your comments to about 2 minutes, as we've asked other testifiers to do, we appreciate it. Welcome. Yes. Introduce yourself, and you can proceed.
Of course. My name is Brody Hagemeyer. I'm from St. Cloud, Minnesota. I'm here representing Students for Life of America, as well as my university, SCSU for Life, our pro-life group at St. Cloud State University. The comments that I have regarding taxpayer funding abortion are these. Taxpayer funding of abortion is an extreme position that many Americans overwhelmingly do not support. A CNN poll showed that 56% of Americans are not in favor of taxpayer funding of abortion. Other polls report similar numbers. To force taxpayers to pay for abortion is an extreme view of the abortion industry. There is no reason taxpayers should pay for abortions when the nation's largest largest abortion provider, Planned Parenthood, brings in over $1 billion on an annual basis, according to their most recent annual report from 2013-2014. Banning taxpayer funding of abortion is a reasonable request which both sides can agree upon, and as a pro-life Democrat myself, I agree that taxpayer funding of abortion should cease in this state and in this country immediately. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it. And one final testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Angela Erickson, and I am the Northern Regional Coordinator for Students for Life of America. We work with over 830 pro-life groups across this country, so I'm here to represent all of those pro-life individuals across our nation. I'll make this short and sweet. Abortion is the taking of life, and no one should be forced to pay for it against their will. As a taxpayer in Minnesota, I disagree with my funding and my taxes being used to end the life of another human being. Science has proven that life begins at conception. Ultrasounds easily show the preborn baby is alive. And abortion takes a life, and therefore, like I said, no one should be forced to pay for it against their will. While the U.S. Supreme Court gave women the right to choose to have an abortion at any time in their pregnancy, for whatever reason, that doesn't mean that taxpayers should be required to fund that choice. Lastly, abortion is not health care, and taxpayer dollars should not be forced to fund it. Contrary to the notion of good medicine and saving lives, abortion actually does neither. Taxpayer dollars should never be used to fund the taking of an innocent life under the guise of health care. Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be here. Members, any questions? Representative Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to correct one thing that I've heard a couple of times in this hearing, and people have characterized Roe v. Wade as saying that abortion can be chosen at any time for any reason, and I don't think that is exactly true. I think that Roe v. Wade set up a system of restriction depending on how far along the pregnancy is, and I just want to correct that, because I think it's really important for people to understand that in fact there is no abortion on demand at any time for any reason. That simply is not true.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we've heard a lot today about taxpayer dollars and how we should be taking care of taxpayer dollars. And I guess the concerns that I have is that sometimes we get so concerned with taxpayer dollars that we forget the damages that occur when we don't have proper dollars floating to support services. And where I get frustrated by it sometimes is where people are saying, you know what, we don't want to fund this process or that process. And at some point it starts raising the questions of, do we start saying, should we start not funding vaccines because some people are concerned about vaccines? But I think the real problem that I have is that I work at a homeless youth shelter, and I want to point out some very hard facts out there. There's that tonight, last night, very cold nights, there are over 2,000 female youth who are on the streets. The problem is that a lot of those youth sometimes are faced with tough choices if they're going to stay warm and survive the night, or risk being outside the entire night or in very unsafe situations. And sometimes they are put into situations where they have no choice. These youth are covered by our state programs, these women. And sometimes they are put in situations where they end up being pregnant afterwards and needing to deal with it. Or, as I have seen, youth who have been abused, coming from very dysfunctional homes where rape or incest has occurred. And when the youth have tried to deal with it, they've been called names, thrown out of the houses and kicked out, saying that they had actually seduced the male in the house and called sluts in the process. Unfortunately, they are pregnant in the process, and now they're trying to figure out how to deal with things because they know if they're pregnant, they're never going to be able to return home at all because of the relationship that was going on. These are real hard facts that we see on a daily basis. Sometimes these youth are faced with no other choice but to have to end a pregnancy, one that they did not choose to have. And unfortunately, they are under the state health care programs. And by saying that we are not going to allow them to be able to make a choice, a free choice that they have, they are stuck with a very unmanageable situation and continues the cycle of poverty. Maybe if we had focused more money in the past on trying to solve some society's problems, we would not be facing as many of these decisions that we are now. But this is the reality that we face. And I feel very strongly, and for the youth out there that are not able to be here tonight because they're trying to figure out how to live and survive, they would be offended by not being able to have, being through a terrible situation, not being able to have a choice and being able to have it taken care of.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we've gone through a few bills that really has attacked the concept of abortion, you know, and I'm really confused whether or not these meetings were meant to, you know, to represent the voice of the woman, whether or not there's a clean, safe facility, you know, whether that really matter or not, you know, whether or not the care of a woman really matters in this or not. I'm really confused, you know, or, you know, I'm hearing a lot of conflicting statements from our testifiers as to why, you know, this issue is so important to her. But I have a question here that I would like to ask of anyone out there. And the question would be, because my hope is that we do care about life in all its stages. So my question is, can you, through your bills and through your ideology, ensure the safety of women who cannot access an abortion because of the cost?
Representative Tice, excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have been part of an organization for many years, and it's called Birthline. And in 1977, I was a client of Birthright, which is now Birthline. And what Birthline does is it provides counseling and help to folks who have a crisis pregnancy. And there are other facilities in St. Cloud as well, the Pregnancy Resource Center, who Birthline works with, because even though they're both crisis centers, they do different things. And so what I can, and I'll speak about Birthline because I know that better. So what they do is they do provide counseling, and they provide support. They provide people who will be in their corner and help them to find out the options that are available. Birthline's mission is to love everyone and to love them where they're at. And if a woman does come in and she decides her only option is abortion, they will do post-abortion counseling because they believe that that woman is that special to them. And even though Birthline is a pro-life group, their mission is to take care of the women and make sure that they're healthy and that they make good choices. So when I come before you with a bill like this, and it's because my constituents are telling me they want something like this. And I do believe that as legislators, we come here with ideas we get from our taxpayers, from our constituents, and it is our job to come before this body and say, we don't believe this is right. I do know from experience that lives can be changed. And not only is it just a solution, but Birthline will work with people to make sure they get back on their feet, to feel sure that they can find some other options. And probably, I know some of the counseling includes going to school, to looking at, you know, bettering themselves and either getting their GED or going on to school. So there are programs out there. It isn't just, I'm not just saying that, you know, it's bad. Being part of Birthline was very, very rewarding in that we really did work with people. And fathers were invited to come with as well. So it was something that I just don't think enough folks know about this. And these programs are out there. So when I come before you with this, it's not just saying that this is what we need to do. I do know that there's options. And I think we need to do a better job of seeing what those options are. And that is what really saddens me the most, that a woman feels like her only option is abortion. And I don't believe that's true. I've seen it. I've seen the folks who have gone through the program and made whatever decision they decided to do. And I've seen them grow and to be very grateful and thankful. So I just wish that there was a way we could do a better job of doing that and not just saying that their only choice is abortion.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
So I would say here in the 21st century, I think there are many women who know that there's options, who know there's choices, that who know and believe that abortion is not the only option that they have, that even when they go into a Planned Parenthood clinic, they are advised, they are given support, they're not just led to the decision of an abortion, you know, and maybe that's a misconception that many have, that is the process, that is their goal, and that is not the goal. The goal is not that process. And so, and again, you know, before Roe versus Wade, we know what that looked like. We knew when women decided to have an abortion and they was determined to have an abortion, what those back alley abortions looked like. It looked like the stories that we was hearing earlier about unlicensed clinics, right? Trying to give us this visual of this dark, dirty, unclean place. Well, we're not at that place. We're not at that place today. And so my question still stands. You know, how can you ensure the safety of a woman who makes the decision that she wants an abortion? Where would we find ourselves today if we decide that a woman who cannot afford an abortion, as it was 40 years ago, how can we ensure her safety, her well-being?
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really don't know that anybody can guarantee anything like that. And I would not want to take on... You can't do that. You can't guarantee anything. What I can guarantee is there's folks out there that are willing to help. And I know that's not the answer you want. But I won't guarantee anything. Just like I can't guarantee that a woman who maybe makes an adoption plan is not going to have some real problems with it. There are no guarantees with any of this. But what I do know is there's a lot of people available to help. And I also know that when I look at the folks in my district, they are not happy about what's currently happening. They would like to match what our federal level is doing, and I don't think that's out of line.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
I just want to read and maybe inform and maybe do a little education with you. Mm-hmm. That what happens when a person is considering an abortion. So abortion is one aspect of health care for women. Today, half of all pregnancy in the U.S. each year are unintended, and 4 of 10 of these are ended by safe and legal abortions. prior to an abortion, a woman who is thinking about ending her pregnancy receive accurate and unbiased information from a healthcare professional about her options, parenting, adoption, and abortion. The patient completes a medical history and has blood testing and an ultrasound when needed to date the pregnancy. She learns how the process works, the range of normal symptoms to expect, and the warning signs to look for. Just like any outpatient medical facility, health centers that provide abortions have staffing, equipment, and referral arrangements in place to handle emergencies in the unlikely event of a complication. So women who choose abortion can reach a medical professional 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to answer questions. In the extreme rare occasion of a complication that requires a hospital visit, emergency room medical professionals are trained to provide the care and intervention that a woman might need. So I say currently we can guarantee some safety there. We can guarantee that if a woman chooses to have an abortion, that she will be safe, she will be cared for, and she will have the information and the support that she needs and options.
Members, any other questions? Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have five sentences, so pretty quick wrap. I, as was explained tremendously by the law professor, it's clearly unconstitutional under the present Minnesota court decisions, but there's a couple other problems. There's a huge problem in when it says state-sponsored health programs. That could be MnSure, it could be MA, it could be MnCare, it could be state employee insurance, could be local government employee insurance and private plans regulated by the state. So that's just an open thing that's not defined at all, so it's pretty meaningless. But really far more important to me than the unconstitutionality is the fact that as a family law attorney, a lot of clients really discussed their lives with me. And I had many clients over the years who had backroom abortions from non-professionals or did it themselves, and they had lasting problems years later, and it really bothered them both physically and mentally. And I just because a woman has a low-paying job shouldn't mean she's subjected to dangerous procedures, especially for unintended pregnancies. And I just don't understand why you're going after low-income people.
Thank you, Representative Mulry. And we do have a brief question from Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a question for clarification from the legal testifier. Why is there the ambiguity that there are multiple cases and settled court cases and people that have been found guilty and served time, been fined, etc., where the definition was that they took the life of an unborn infant? They didn't do it in the procedures in abortion. They did it with a vehicle, a drunk driver. They did it as a assault with either, you know, a foot, a fist, a knife, or other instrument. And the courts, the state, does not hesitate to say that is the taking of a human life, and therefore there is ambiguity, and it's the only people that are allowed to take the same definition of a human life are people performing abortions. And so it's a bit of a rhetorical question, because we all know the answer that yes, in one hand, the ending of that life is a crime, a serious crime. On the other hand, it's not. And you know, you can dance all you want and say it's settled, but you know, there's ambiguity there, and we need to realize it.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we keep hearing today that these bills are not about restricting abortion, they're not about ending abortion, but clearly they are. Those of you who are newer here, these kinds of bills come up year after year after year. And it's always the same thing, and sometimes they don't change at all. And this very bill has been vetoed, I believe, last year. And so here it is again. I just really want to respond to this issue about people not wanting to pay for abortions. In the society that we live in the way that we do our government, citizens don't get to pick and choose everything they want to pay for and don't want to pay for. It's just a fact of life. I think many of us would like not to pay for drone strikes to go and kill people overseas, and yet our tax dollars do that, and we don't get to opt out of some particular action by our government that we don't want to, that we don't agree with. There are many things that even health procedures that certain taxpayers might not want to pay for. Do they want to pay for vasectomies? Do they want to pay for poor women's births? You know, I would guess there are probably many constituents who would say, you know, if women get pregnant and they can't afford the baby, why should we pay for that birth? Why should we pay for that delivery? And in fact, that's a much more expensive cost. Certainly, I've heard that in relation to our MFIP program. Some taxpayers don't want to pay for poor women who have children who can't support themselves. Well, we don't make those decisions as individuals. We pay our taxes. We elect our representatives. You know, I understand, Representative Tice, you're doing what you think you're, and Representative Pugh, you're doing what you think that you're being asked to do. When I knock on doors, I have very, very few people bring this up as an issue. And I guess that just reflects the kind of districts we're from. But the Supreme Court, our Minnesota Supreme Court, has spoken on this. And at least here in Minnesota, being poor does not mean that you don't get to make the same reproductive choices that you would make if you had money. And I think Minnesotans, if they really think about it, I think most Minnesotans would agree with that, that we politicians should not be making choices for women about their most intimate issues, that women are capable of making those choices themselves, and they should not be prevented from that and be sent out to get a back alley abortion and put their life and their health at risk because they happen to be poor. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just request a roll call.
Okay. Representative Mulry, request a roll call. There will be a roll call. Members, I don't see anyone else with questions or comments. I just had a brief comment, and then we'll let the authors of the bill have a final word, and we will go to the roll call vote. Members and people of the audience, thank you so much for being here today. We always tend to have these conversations sometime during a biennium, and they're not easy conversations to have, and some would disagree with bringing them forward at all, while others, this is really fundamental to why they come to the legislature. And I just want to say to those who feel like this might be an attack on women or on women's rights, that at least speaking for myself, and I think other people around this table, there's nothing that could be farther from the truth. The fact of the matter is that this issue is about a life that has no say, and the fact that many of us around this table can't agree on when a life is a life. And that is the crux of this, many of these issues around the contention around this issue. And that's where the rub is. That's where the challenge is. And sometimes it's misconstrued as going after women or after caring about women and their rights and their privacy and things of that nature. But the other half of that argument is there's a life involved who has no say. And there are people that think that it's important to be a voice for those. And unintended pregnancies are certainly not something that we wish upon anyone, and need to do things to put supports in place for those women in that situation. But I just want to speak on behalf of, as the chair of this committee, why these bills came forward. And it is for the unborn that many of us are passionate about protecting, and certainly that's something we don't all agree on is, again, what a life is. But from my perspective, it's an important piece of what we're here to discuss and decide as legislators and as public policy. And so thank you for taking the time. It's not an easy committee. It never is. But thank you to the authors for bringing these bills forward and to the thoughtful comments and questions from the members of the committee. So with that, Representative Pugh and Representative Tice, if you could just briefly close out on your bill, and we'll go to a vote.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I really appreciate your consideration of this bill. I have voted in support of pro-life bills before, but I've never spoken up about it. But it was, I felt it incumbent upon myself to do so. Again, you know, I've spoken with my constituency repeatedly, and this issue has come up, and when it has, this is the common ground. You know, this is a very contentious issue, but this is the common ground that my constituency has spoken to, that it's just not right to make them pay for an abortion, for whatever reason. And, you know, Representative Liebling, I appreciate your comments and acknowledging that we're bringing these bills because we are responding, you know, to our constituency, just as each and every one of us do with any bills that we bring before the legislature. And to your point, when you commented that, you know, we pay taxes and, you know, we can't opt out, well, the thought immediately crossed my mind that my constituency is in the process and has been, over the course of the last 2 years, opting out of Minnesota, of staying in Minnesota. I have a running total of 13 states that my constituents have relocated to based on the taxes and just the onerous, you know, regulations, small business owners. I could go on and on. That'll be another conversation. So I'm really ultra sensitive, maybe more so than some, but about the taxation, and this is an issue that I've heard about. And I would just comment that, you know, to Representative Moran's really, you know, sensitive and sincere, you know, questioning, and the comments that you made. You started out with the comment about, you know, abortion being health care, and I've specifically heard repeatedly from my constituency, and I agree with them on this point that abortion isn't health care. So there's a difference of opinion on, you know, a lot of aspects of this really sensitive subject matter. So I just want to say that, you know, this is obviously a matter that we're, you know, going to, you know, have to agree to disagree and continue the conversation. But it's really important to me, and I appreciate your consideration of supporting this bill and moving this along to the next committee. Thank you. Representative Tice.
Madam Chair, thank you. I really do appreciate the opportunity to be here today. This is important to my district, and it always has been, and it is important to me as well. If anything comes out of this, I hope more people realize that there are some organizations out there to help and to reach out for that help. I would rather see that happen than changing law. But as far as the constitutionality of it, I believe that we all have an obligation to do what our district believes is right. And if it is to challenge current law, so be it. I'm willing to take that chance. And really what we're asking for is to do what our federal government is doing as well. So with that, thank you very much, and I would certainly appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Okay, members, with that, there is a roll call on the bill, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mack.
Yes.
Vice Chair Peterson.
Yes.
DFL Lead Mullery.
No.
Albright.
Yes.
Allen. Backer.
Yes.
Baker.
Yes.
Dean.
Yes.
Fisher.
No.
Franson.
Yes.
Freiberg.
No.
Kelly.
Yes.
Liebling.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Lohmer.
Yes.
Mason.
No.
Moran.
No.
Pearson.
Yes.
Quam.
Oui.
Schumacher.
Yes.
Schultz.
No.
Zerwas.
Thank you.
Members, there being 12 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you, Representative Tice and Representative Pugh. Members, that concludes our business for the day. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to just make one further comment because I think it's not fair. You know, I heard the chair characterize why the pro-choice side feels as it does. And I think that there was a misstatement there. And I think we should speak for ourselves about what the difference is in our views. The difference is not when life begins. Different people may have different views about when life begins. I think I can speak for the pro-choice side in saying that what we believe is that each individual woman should decide what she believes. It's not when I believe life begins. It's when that woman, who's as much entitled to make that decision as I am, it's what she believes and how she balances those interests. And I think that is the difference. And I just think that needs to be said because, you know, for you it may be when life begins, but there may be members here who believe that it begins when you believe it begins and still feel that another person should be able to make that decision for herself. So thank you for letting me say that.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Liebling. And I think probably a lot of mischaracterizations come from both sides. And just very transparently, I've just had conversations with people that we disagree and have understood that that tends to be one of the common areas of divide, but I appreciate your comments. And with that, members, our next committee hearing is on Friday at 10:30. Members, we are adjourned.